Well, that was amazing. That was amazing. The wonders of technology. Isn't that great? Couldn't it be great if we get the whole congregation up there just flashing through that? That'd be fantastic. See if we can do that, the technical people, if you'd take a look at that over this next couple of weeks, that would be terrific. Welcome to this fourth Sunday in Advent, of course, Christmas Sunday, a very special time. It's already been mentioned about Christmas Eve, 7 o'clock, just registered to come here physically to the building. We look forward to worshiping with every one of you out there, and we'll enjoy that and looking forward to it. Also, next Sunday, as we mentioned already, there will be no one here in the building, but you'll be able to access us through technology, and we'll be worshiping together on the 27th. Well, shopping is done. Right? Typical question this time of year. Typical question. That's the first thing I usually ask someone just to get a conversation moving. I can't complain because most of the shopping in our house happens with the other person who I live with. So, but it is stressful. I start thinking about it in October because it's just stressful for me. I just find it typical of guys like me who just wander through the mall aimlessly looking for something that looks interesting or remotely rings a bell in our minds. I'm not sure where the gift thing came from. I'm not sure what the tradition is with that. I'm sure some of you can text me this week and tell me where it is. I'm happy it did. It certainly wasn't invented in 1500 by some mall owner in Germany to increase sales, although that would have been a good idea. Very likely it's an expression of the gift of Jesus coming to us and our expression to give something to someone else to reflect that great gift of Jesus. Probably came somewhere about the gifts of the wise men who came and brought three gifts to Jesus. Don't know how many wise men there were, but there were three gifts. And that may be the tradition as well. We're a long way from that now, and that's lost in the mist of history as we experience gift-giving and all the materialism that goes with it. What do you know you're getting for Christmas? What do you know for sure that you're getting for Christmas? Do you have confidence in that? Well, as a 12-year-old, the thing I really wanted the most, and I can see it right now, I can see my house in Winnipeg, I wanted a hockey stick. I wanted a new hockey stick. It wasn't a curved hockey stick. They weren't even invented at that point. Bobby Hull hadn't even taken a shot with a curved hockey stick, but I wanted a hockey stick. How do you disguise a hockey stick? When I came down from the bedroom and snuck my head around the corner after the required time of waiting in the morning, I turned around and there it was, leaned up against the wall, a wrapped hockey stick. And I knew that was for me. That was, most of you would have asked, have been asked, what do you want for Christmas? And you would have had a choice, so you would have known what you were getting for Christmas. Most guys like me, I must admit, don't have a clue really what they want. It's kind of a stretch at times and probably something we want to go out and just buy ourselves, which is why there are so many gifts under the tree in our family from Santa, because Santa knows what I want. And after the fourth gift is opened from Santa, there's a strange feeling in the room that perhaps there's some conspiracy going on there. So I know actually what I am getting from Santa under the tree. In my case, I knew there was something coming from Aunt Silva, my mom's only sister from Cleveland. I knew what I was getting from her because she sent the same thing every year for years. Clothes made by a friend of hers, sent to us children. She kept sending them every year. They never fit properly. They were a family joke, and no one had the courage to actually tell her about that. So they just kept coming and coming and coming. Finally, when I became a teenager, she sent me Avon cologne for men. A very disturbing gift. This stuff was lethal. You could know it was coming 100 miles away. I mean, it came before I even entered a room. People knew I was coming. The label said musk. That brings back some really strong memories for some of you. It likely affected my dating life. I don't remember much. I just blanked it out at that point. What was the gift that you weren't expecting at all? The best gift of all. Last year was my turntable that Meredith gave me, and the look of pleasure on her face as she gave it to me was priceless, and it still is. What do you want for Christmas if you could have anything this year? What do you want for Christmas if you could have anything at all this year? Well, Tuesday night it was a furnace because our furnace blew up, and by Thursday you could leave the milk out all night because it was going to be just real fresh in the morning. That lasted till yesterday, so we really wanted a furnace and we're praying for that. COVID has changed everything. However, a return to normal would be a good gift. It would be a gift that I would love, quote-unquote normal, whatever that means. A different job. Did you know that a quarter of Canadians, when polled, want to change jobs because of COVID? A quarter. That's quite a few. Moving up a surgery date from a canceled appointment due to the lack of beds and surgical options. Being able to visit parents and kids and grandkids. That just overrules anything under the tree that you might get, or any gift whatsoever. Just a chance to prove yourself, a position, some opportunity, some door that would open to help you flourish. If you could have anything you want. I don't often watch the Antiques Roadshow. It's one of those things that you just click on the TV and there it is. But this one, which was 2 weeks ago, a woman bought a painting. She'd bought it at an antique store in London for £50, about $90 Canadian. She was very curious about it, so she brought it to the Antique Roadshow. The appraiser, in a very calm tone, gave her the history of the artist, that it might be that person, the important period that this painting might represent in the history of art. He even commented on the small little detail in the painting that may have given it away that it could be that famous artist. He kept saying the phrase, possibly, possibly, possibly. The woman looked downcast. She looked kind of, oh, this isn't worth anything. There was this uncomfortable pause, and then he said these immortal words. After consulting my colleagues, another long pause, we believe this to be an authentic painting worth about £250,000. If you put it up for auction, you'll probably get £500,000. It represents a highlight and a lost period in this artist's life and is priceless. Everyone on the set turned around and she almost fainted. She literally almost fainted in the chair. Sometimes you don't know what you've got. Sometimes you just don't know what you have. Well, we have a package to unwrap this morning. And my simple question is it the most important gift you could ever receive or anyone could ever receive? I know it's a very simple question, but picking up on the theme of what we experience every Christmas season and what we experience out there in our culture, what is the most important gift you could possibly be given? Are we prepared to unwrap that particular package? The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. For unto us a child is born, to unto us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. He will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace. Isaiah knows he is speaking for God in this passage. He's writing about 740 B.C., Of all the writers in the Old Testament, Isaiah understood most clearly what God was up to. He warns us of the dangers and the places of safety, both now and in the future. The New Testament quotes Isaiah 66 times. He sees Jesus coming. He sees God's hand in history, ready to do a dramatic act. He is ready to redeem and heal and set things right. Jesus himself meditated on Isaiah. He loved the teachings of Isaiah. He read Isaiah. It taught him about his true mission. It focused him on the true mission of God. Isaiah read his culture. He saw God's hand in history. He never lost hope. Isaiah 46 verse 9 says, "Remember your history, your long and rich history. I am God, the only God you've had or ever will have, incomparable, irreplaceable, from the very beginning, telling you what the ending will be, all along letting you in on what is going to happen." These words are from God, Isaiah says. Listen very carefully to what he's up to. The state of Israel had been through a very difficult period. Recently, it had been through the period of King Uzziah, positive, but now things had turned very dark. King Ahaz is trying to make a pact with the Assyrians, a massive force of evil intent upon dealing with them from the north. Stephen talked about this last week. This was being written just as the Assyrians wipe out the entire northern tribes of Israel. In 734, the battle is joined, and in 722, they're dragged off to captivity. And now they're poised to go into the south. And Isaiah stands on the precipice, as this is about to happen to his own country. The Assyrians were brutal. Tiglath-Pileser III, if the name wasn't difficult enough for number one and number two, Tiglath-Pileser III had already flattened Damascus to the north. He's on his way, and the southern kingdom is nervous, and justifiably so. I remember standing in the Bekaa Valley in Baalbek, which is just an incredible ruins, where this army would have come through. They had to come through the Bekaa Valley to take Damascus and to do what they did. Standing there and realizing that this army had walked through the very place that I stood. Not only is there war in the north, there's laws being compromised, economy is collapsing, there's rampant occultism, there's political upheaval, there's neglect of the poor, general social breakdown, and the rot has started to set in. And Isaiah begins to speak in that context. There's utter darkness. People are consulting mediums and spiritualists. Isaiah chapter 8, when people tell you, try out the fortune tellers, consult the spiritualists, why not just go tap into the spirit world as well and get in touch with the dead? You are cursing God. You are cursing God. The nation's in trouble. Isaiah chapter 5, I will sing for the one I love a song about his vineyard. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside, but now I will tell you what I'm going to do with my vineyard. I will take away its hedge and it will be destroyed. I will break down its wall and it will be trampled. The nation has started to rot. Isaiah chapter 3, Jerusalem staggers. Jerusalem is falling. Their words and deeds are against the Lord, defying his glorious presence. And where have they ended up? To frame Isaiah as he begins to move into a very different place. Distressed and hungry, they will roam through the land. When they're famished, they will become enraged, and looking upward, they will curse their king and their God. Then they will look toward the earth and see only distress and darkness and fearful gloom, and they will be thrust into utter darkness, and the people will blame God. Something is wrong. And then this glorious passage, this vision of Isaiah, who sees past and through all of these things in his day, and now in our day, he foresaw this. Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom. For those who were in distress in the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the future, he will honor Galilee by the way of the sea along the Jordan. These are Isaiah's words. He says, Zebulun and Naphtali have already been taken. Those are the tribes in the north, and it's beginning to move south. He says, that is done. Those are the first provinces that were humbled and humiliated. But then he breaks into this, but something's happening in Galilee, and something is going to happen in Galilee to the east. A light will shine. A child will be born. This is where Jesus spent most of his time, in Galilee. The light will shine. There'll be no more gloom. Jesus brings the light to fulfill what Isaiah had predicted. God will intervene. He will not stand still. He will make himself known. He will show up. There's no more gloom. There will be a great light that will illuminate a crisis. And the time now has been accomplished. And now 750 years later, Jesus comes on the scene. And Matthew, in recording this, and recording the life of Jesus, announces what's happening behind the scenes as he pulls back the curtain and he quotes Isaiah directly, this very passage. Leaving Nazareth, Matthew chapter 4, he went and lived in Capernaum, which was by the lake in the area of Zebulun and Naphtali, to fulfill what was said through the prophet Isaiah, land of Zebulun and land of Naphtali by the sea along the Jordan. The people living in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. The link has been made by Matthew. He has seen what has taken place. He links the heart and the soul of what Isaiah is preaching about and speaking about and giving encouragement about, and he brings it into the present. What has happened in Isaiah's day is the same story in Jesus' day, and it's the same prefiguring of what is going on today. It's the same human story. The child predicted has been born. Jesus steps out of the shadows. He leaves his hometown Nazareth. He moves to Capernaum. In so doing, he leaves the past behind. He has moved to the most northerly place in Palestine. Galilee is only 50 miles from north to south and 25 miles wide from east to west. It was a fertile land. It was densely populated. There were 204 villages in Galilee, all with a population around 15,000 people. Surrounded by non-Jewish ideas, very open and pluralistic, Jesus began his ministry here. It was a tough place to be. It was a pluralistic environment. Does this sound familiar? But all this is background. It's background, but it's an important story that we quote and we sing about. We take this passage in Isaiah chapter 9. We see it as a prefiguring of what Jesus would be and who he was. Matthew and the gospel writers pick it up and they tell the story afresh and again. We come to this day. And it's as relevant then as it is now. What is the greatest single gift we can open at Christmas? Well, we have to change the narrative. We are so overwhelmed and buried under our materialistic culture and all the things that we receive in this season that it's so hard to grasp this. Christmas is about light entering the darkness. Jesus is about light entering the darkness. The people walking in darkness, verse 2, have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. It's why we put lights in our houses. It's why we light candles. We illuminate the darkness. We call out the darkness. It's a huge present for us. Can we see it? It's immeasurable. When the light comes, the darkness disappears. And we need this because the shadows are so dark and things are hidden and the true nature of the tentativeness of life haunts us all. This is actually the child of COVID. In the third week of April, a trusted reader of our culture when asked, what is it that most people are sensing? He said this, quote unquote, "What we are experiencing universally is the collective expression of mortality. The measure of success in our culture is to postpone death for as long as possible." He says that's why there's this angst. That's why there's this subterranean sense that not everything is well. COVID has taken that to a new level. COVID has brought the specter of death as close as the next contact we might breathe with. It's a scary prospect. And I'm not playing down the threat that's in the slightest, but as believers, we don't live in the shadow of death. We cannot cheat death in the end. The darkness and terror and fear of death is absolutely taken away. It disappears. It is a non-starter. If eternity is what it is the most incalculable gift we could ever hold on to, we could ever receive. Things are going to be all right. Our life will be enlarged. Verse 3, you have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. Things are going to be enlarged within us. There's an incredible quote in the Advent book that Meredith and I read every year, and I want you to just listen to this very brief paragraph about enlargement. Waiting does not diminish us any more than waiting diminishes a pregnant mother. We are enlarged in the waiting. We, of course, don't see what is enlarging us, but the longer we wait, the larger we become, and the more joyful our expectancy. With such motivation, we can wait as we sense God is indeed with us and at work within us as he was with Mary as the child within her grew. I just think that's a remarkable image of what is enlarging within us through this time. We deal with death. But the enlarging of the spirit of what God brings to us. And we will be liberated from oppression. You have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. Liberation from oppression is God's calling card. It's mostly from being a prisoner of sin, those things which separate us from him and the results of sin. People being imprisoned in physical deprivation and starvation and ignorance. Children at risk in sweatshops and trafficking. The dead-end boundaries that always recourse to death. We need to be set free from many things. Jesus picks this up in his first public message. He pulls out the scroll of, yes, Isaiah 61. The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he's anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. He rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, sat down. The eyes of everyone in the synagogue were fastened on him. And he began saying to them, today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing. What a remarkable thing. Light entered the darkness. Death is diminished. Our expectation is enlarged. Our oppression is lifted. This was an amazing child. For unto us a son is born. Unto us a son is given. And the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. The birth of a child, an actual baby, vulnerable, completely dependent in early life. God trusting us as custodians of a young toddler, and then the child, and then this young man's life. Trusting him as a young rabbi, standing up to the priests and the religious leaders and the Roman officials, and even his own disciples, never recanting who he understood himself to be. This baby in the manger isn't just a feel-good factor at this time of year, isn't just some creche that we put in our homes or in churches or in malls. He's about to be killed by Herod. This is serious stuff. This has serious consequences. Christmas isn't just a wonderful pick-me-up for 10 days. It has to be deeper. Is it the greatest gift? That you have ever been given. We're buried under the spell of comfort and materialism and information. It is just so hard to see. And then there's these brief, extraordinary phrases. Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. What you name your child is significant. What to expect in the future. What you are trusting will take place in this person's life. Underlying this whole section is this one theme. He's going to bring order out of chaos. Wonderful Counselor. He will unleash the wisdom and guide you to a supernatural existence. He will crack open the very meaning of life, where you will spend eternity. It also means someone who changes a person's heart and character. Someone who invests his life in your future. Jesus says, I am the way and the truth and the life. Follow me. He not only preached the Sermon on the Mount, he lived it. Father, forgive them. It's a staggering thing. Wonderful Counselor releasing his character into our character. He stands with us. Mighty God. The word in the Hebrew literally is El Gibor, which means El, God, Gibor, mighty. It means literally like father, like son. The very things that the Father possesses and is in his character is invested in the Son. He is a miracle worker. His power is everlasting. His power is miraculous. Isaiah even predicted that great things would happen in Galilee. He will honor Galilee of the Gentiles by the way of the sea along the Jordan. Isaiah sees it clearly. Everlasting Father, the Creator. There from the beginning, all things hold together, the eternal dimension. This child is bringing the character of God into clear focus. The everlasting God, the door of eternity is swinging wide open. Jesus lived, was taught, crucified, died, and rose from the dead, walked on the face of the earth. I can get you through life and death. I can get you there. You will be free. Prince of Peace. Well, this is a tougher one. You can get really sarcastic on this one. Life is evil. Life is messy. Nigeria, Syria, Ethiopia, the Mideast. In the last 4,000 years, 8,000 signed peace treaties have been broken. In the last 400 years in Europe, there have been 286 wars. The problem with the lack of peace is our problem. It's in our hearts. Jesus' peace creates not only an end, but total integration and well-being. And he will do this forever. He will accomplish it. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. On the cross, Jesus says, it is finished, it is accomplished. Tetelesti. Tetelesti. It is finished. Something is done. The mortgage has been discharged. The roof has been finished. The mortgage has been paid. The thesis has finally been completed. Tetelesti. Something is finally finished. The very answers to life, your future. And then these words from Isaiah as we close. The wolf will live with the lamb, the leopard will lie down with the goat, and the calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow will feed with the bear, their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. The infant will play near the hole of the cobra, and the young child will put his hand into the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Isn't that something you just want to open up? It just cannot be ignored. If you're anxious, those lacking self-confidence, God is in control. He's broken into human affairs. And through all the tears, he is present powerfully. Every throne and power structure is at his feet. For those that have doubts and are just overcome, 2 Corinthians, let the light shine out of the darkness. Make his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. The way we know God is to look in the face of Christ. We can't do it just through nature, but through Jesus. He shattered the yoke. You've received freedom, and you've received liberty. For to us is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. Your government, my government, the way I do things, the way I organize and order my life, the government, my government, is on his shoulders. It is his concern now. We cannot ignore this gift. Please don't ignore this gift. Lord Jesus, we bring to you all that we are to this day, and we thank you. We thank you that as we gather, reading Isaiah, as it breaks into the New Testament through the gospel writers, we can hold on to you, for the light has brought recovery from those things which bind us and bury us and give us discomfort and frustration and angst. Release us into your presence. Give us this gift, Lord, and may we receive it with thanksgiving. In the name of our Savior, amen.